I'm Wayne Brittenden for the Political Compass, and we're welcoming Stanford University Professor Paul Ehrlich, a renowned biologist whose groundbreaking 1968 bestseller, The Population Bomb, raised mass awareness of the consequences of an unchecked population explosion. Paul, welcome to our podcast. I'm thinking about the heightened awareness that you created, and people were talking then about ZPG, zero population growth. We don't hear that anymore, although there is talk of population connection. What's the difference?
Well, I think one of the differences is that people who want to keep making money by having more consumers aren't doing a very effective job very objective job for some time on getting the whole issue of how many people there are on the planet, and that's that impact on our life support systems and our political systems and so on away from the mass media. There's occasional things that are brought up, but not very many. And people, for instance, I'm at what may be the best university in the world, Stanford University in California. It's a like the rest of the universities, a 19th century institution that's clueless about what's going on in the world. I'm sorry to say they've been very successful. Recently, things have been slowly coming back. There, for example, the scientific community has repeatedly stated that if we don't do something about the population problem, starting in the 1990s, by the way, the whole scientific community has stated on the importance of dealing with the population problem. In 1993, I believe it was, all the academies of science in all the nations got out a joint statement saying that population was a very serious problem. And it wasn't even covered in the New York Times. You can't even Google it and find it. So I'm sorry to say the opposition has been very successful, and I've been a failure.
Well, if Stanford's clueless, what hope is there for the rest of us?
A very good question. I mean, for example, during the Vietnam War, at least in the United States, Stanford, Berkeley, and many other universities were hotbeds of protest. There were teach-ins. There were courses around it and so on, and things were very, very active in the general public and under the leadership of universities, and to a large degree in university students, people were making a big attempt to change the situation. The situation in the U.S. and in Australia, I'm a part-time Aussie, now the universities are just producing little parts for the machine, making sure they're well-oiled and never asking where the machine is going. There's not a hint of protest or discussion of the huge problems facing society at Stanford today. As an institution, you can go all the way through Stanford without knowing how many people there are in the world, what an ecosystem service is, what the second law of thermodynamics tells us about energy, why the U.S. has troops all over the world, and so on and so forth. It's a part of the machinery now.
In the age of the corporatized university, has the university abandoned its essential role as the critic and conscience of society?
The answer is yes. Worse yet, it's become a part and parcel of what's wrong with society. The growth mania, for example, even there's a wonderful book by a professor in a business school saying why you should close business schools because they do such a miserable job. If they did a good job, it'd be even worse because you get even more heedless growth that we can't afford. So I hate to say it. I love Stanford. I've had a wonderful time here. They've treated me and everything but salary very well. In other words, been able to do and say whatever I want, but it doesn't do any good. The university it's still structured as an old friend of mine who you probably aren't old enough to know set things up, a guy named Aristotle. he invented disciplines, and people now talk about the importance of being interdisciplinary, but of course the disciplines are all wrong. You know, there's not a important human problem that could be solved within one of our disciplinary departments. Humanities
departments are pretty strapped for cash in most universities in the world now. History departments have even closed down. Anthropology is on the decline. So people are not getting a universe in their university education.
No, I slightly off the subject. I happened to be in Leipzig, Germany, when Trump secured the nomination for president. And I was giving a general talk on environmental problems to a big public audience in Leipzig. And I just went off the, as at the time it was not considered right, but I went off and compared how Trump was getting into power with how Hitler got into power. And interestingly enough, a whole bunch of Germans came up to me afterwards and thanked me for doing that, because in their school systems, they're told a little bit about the Holocaust, but they're not told about the interaction, how the Nazi Party actually under Hitler got to be in charge of Germany and how fast they changed things. And the parallels with Trump are truly scary in almost every dimension.
Well, certainly there's a shared social base there. I mean, the Nazi Party didn't hold sway in the Hamburgs and the Berlins. It was very much a frightened provincial social base, wasn't it?
Yeah, and they also, Hitler was very clever. There was, of course, a lot of problems tracing to the economic situation in the Weimar Republic. But basically, Krupp, for example, urged the president, Hindenburg, not to appoint Hitler chancellor. He was dead against it. He thought Hitler would be a disaster. But like the Republicans after Trump got in, as soon as Hitler became chancellor, Krupp became a Nazi and made a lot of money. And right now we have a Nazi trying to run the country and lots of his minions making lots of money and backing up everything he does, including, by the way, they're getting the judicial system is being turned now, just like the justice system and judicial system were in Germany. If you look at Barr, who's our attorney general, whenever I see him, I think of Ernst Röhm. Do you know who Ernst Röhm was?
Yes.
He was the head of the brown shirts, the Sturmabteilung, the organized criminals that enforced Hitler's views in Germany.
Yeah. But Trump, is Trump the problem, or is he symptomatic of the problem?
He's symptomatic of the problem, but again, individuals make a big difference. And he has managed to reverse norms we thought were essentially irreversible. Those of us who've studied the evolution of norms thought it would take, as it did with smoking, for example, decades to change major norms. And yet he's changed major norms in a matter of months in some cases. And of course, the basis for the change was already there. Yeah. And somebody else, other people have pushed in his direction, but he has been amazingly successful for somebody who, among other things, is totally ignorant. In other words, he knows nothing about the world, or at least he never doesn't demonstrate that he knows anything about the world.
Sure. I think you put your finger on it when you said that the basis for change was there, because under the Obama administration, Obama's had a pretty easy ride with the U.S. population. He's emollient. He's an appealing character. He isn't a bull in a china shop like the incumbent. But nevertheless, he authorized the National Defense Authorization Act. He expanded the extrajudicial executions of people around the world. He expanded the nuclear arsenal.
He used drones to terrorize people. He made
Indeed.
The biggest mistake
Indeed.
Of
so,
all.
So wouldn't more progressive people be howling from the rooftops if Trump had done some of this?
I'm sure they would have. But again, I mean, one of the things that I shouldn't say amuses me, but always stuns me, is people saying that if we do X, Y, and Z, our troops in Afghanistan or Syria or somewhere else will be under threat. They never ask the question, why the hell are our troops there? And of course, the answer, which they don't talk about, is oil and money in most cases. Very few of our commentators, political commentators, say anything about that. The big exception is Noam Chomsky, who has really done a good job of exposing America's state terrorism around the world and so on, and other countries' state terrorism. But he doesn't get in the mass media. He's not paid attention to. His analyses are not widely known, at least not widely enough. So one of the problems in the U.S. is that the corporations control the media, and there's some things you can say in the mass media, and there's other things that they won't invite you back if you say them.
Chomsky himself made the point that it's permissible to argue within defined margins as passionately as you want, but if you step outside those margins, it's not a goer. And I'm very much aware of that when we talk about climate change. There's almost no discussion about the prevailing economic orthodoxy, which depends on growth for its very survival. Neoliberalism is a growth-orientated economic system, and in the climate change debate, it's hardly mentioned that the economic orthodoxy is in conflict with the environmental imperative.
That drives me nuts all the time. Even worse, not even worse, but also even today, you get dramatic weather events that are very strange and clearly tied to some degree to the overall change in the climate, like, for instance, terrible tornadoes in the middle of the winter in Tennessee recently. But the connection there, for example, to not to just growth in general, but the population growth directly. There's a wonderful paper in which an analysis was done showing that if you had one fewer child in terms of greenhouse gas emissions, that was equivalent to giving up driving entirely 24 times. That is, it's saved avoided more greenhouse emissions than you could avoid if you could persuade yourself and 23 of your friends to give up driving.
I'm really interested that you mentioned that. At some point, we're going to have to connect more specifically with population because people will want to hear what you have to say about that today. But in connection with the greenhouse gases, what are we to make of the little reported phenomenon of global dimming, where we're now at a point where the fossil fuels are creating a mask from the greenhouse gases, and if we slow down fossil fuel burning, we're actually going to heat the world up faster?
It's very difficult. First of all, in fairness, I'm not an atmospheric physicist, so I don't know the exact answers, except that the people I do know are concerned about that, trying to model it, and so on. And there are lots of other things that one should be concerned about, like how much of the methane that's tied up in permafrost is going to get out when we keep melting the permafrost, and heating is driving carbon out of soils in various places. There's some very good studies, all relatively local, on that. So there are lots of feedback loops that can make the climate change situation, or rather, I would tend to call it climate disruption because it's worse than change. But we don't know enough about it. The things we do know are if we keep burning fossil fuels, we are going to be screwing over civilization.
And yet, you know, with the global dimming theory, it's argued that if we stop burning fossil fuels, we'll heat the world up faster. After 9/11, when a lot of flights were cancelled, there was a perceptible raise in temperature.
No, that's certainly true, but we don't know how they balance, and you're going to have to stop burning the fossil fuels sooner or later, and sooner to face that problem is better than later, when the problem will be even worse. In other words, if there's even more CO2 in the atmosphere when we stop when we slow down or halt the dimming, then it's going to be much, much worse. There are a lot of problems like that. That is, changing is going to make problems, but waiting to change is going to make even bigger problems.
Yes. Paul, getting back to 1968 and the bombshell book, The Population Bomb, there was so much discussion about zero population growth and the implications of what you were setting out in your book. Yet the world population was a little less than half what it is now. How come there was heightened awareness then, and now population barely goes into the radar?
Well, the part is what I said before. That is a huge, well-financed campaign by the same people that are trying to get us to continue burning fossil fuels, to keep manufacturing guns for everybody, and so on. That all traces back to money once again. If you want to know what's going on in the world, as we've designed it, you got to basically follow the money. But also, the people are not as directly affected by the serious parts of climate disruption and population-driven climate disruption because those who have power in the media are not affected. If the price of food goes up, the people who own the mass media just make more money. Look at the person who's probably in the future killed more people in the future than any other human being. His name is Rupert Murdoch, and he personally has been responsible for stalling any change made on climate disruption and on population through his propaganda network.
Right, not only propaganda, but surely his skill and his resources as an entertainer, because in those heady days of the 70s, it seemed that people were demanding the right to know. Sometimes it feels now as if they really demand the right not to know and welcoming of any distractions.
Yeah, no question about it. And also another fairly serious problem, which you doubtless thought about, is the fractionation of the media so that everybody can find a media outlet that will fit right in with their prejudices. There isn't anything that's even semi-neutral on the line. It's not. It's very hard for people who don't pay a lot of attention to find out where to go to get anything that resembles the real information. False news is everywhere and generated purposely.
Isn't there a pretty large swathe of the population that doesn't have an appetite for reality or a very limited appetite for reality?
Well, where would they get the appetite? In other words, school systems don't teach people to think for themselves. Universities certainly don't. I should say there are exceptions. Obviously, virtually every university has some faculty members that try and, you know, do things that will help save civilization and make the world better. But most academicians are only looking for pay and action in their little area. That's the typical human being. Same thing with scientists. Function primarily to get points from their colleagues. And what happens to the world doesn't, first of all, they don't perceive it. And second of all, if they did, they would listen to the people who say scientists should, you know, shoemakers, stick to your last. You probably heard that expression. Mm. Don't interfere. Don't talk about things that are outside of where you were trained, what area you got your PhD in. It's back to the old disciplinary.
In that case, Chomsky would have stayed as a linguist and not given us so much more.
Yeah, actually, it's interesting that I disagree with him on some basic things in linguistics and agree with him almost totally in politics. The dullest thing I can think of is sticking to your last, being a shoemaker who does nothing in his life but make shoes. And when you see the problems confronting humanity, people ought to spend time studying what's going on, make up their own minds. You see, my voice is now going, and that's a hangover for spending 3 weeks in Sydney in the smoke when it was in November. I have not yet recovered from it.
The problems that we're facing now, obviously, everyone's talking about climate change. Everyone's talking about the virus. But we've got water security to contend with, we've got peak oil, food security, and even the nuclear threat, which is more immediately apocalyptic than climate change potentially, because according to the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, we're at the most dangerous level in the doomsday clock since 1953.
I know a lot of people that have been involved in that, and that is absolutely, as far as I can tell, accurate. And part of it goes back to Obama and his very big mistake in deciding to update the U.S. nuclear triad to a degree which makes the Russians think that we're preparing for a first strike. Americans can't imagine that. They don't know anything about it. I keep asking people what they know about the triad, and they don't even know what the triad is. And they don't know that point, that things are more dangerous now on the nuclear front than at the height of the Cold War, maybe more dangerous at any time than since the Cuban Missile Crisis. And they also don't understand that the collapse that we're, the environmental collapse we're moving towards might be recoverable over decades or centuries, but a large-scale nuclear war, and I was personally involved in the studies there, a large-scale nuclear war would probably make it impossible for civilization ever to restart, even if there were survivors.
In connection with the virus, again, talking of things nuclear, there's a lot of discussion about the effects on the economy and how it's affecting the stock market, but the word absenteeism is hardly ever mentioned, yet we've got a whole lot in with China and with the just-in-time economy and our reliance on components of all kinds of essential things, from medical components to mechanical ones, armies of trucks taking food across continents, shiploads of coal and oil essential for keeping the power grid running. We're not talking about absenteeism and indeed what it might mean to the 450 world's nuclear reactors if the technicians are ill or even dead from the virus.
And what I've been saying to people repeatedly here is that we don't know enough about the virus to know exactly how it will affect individuals and how easily it'll be transmitted, how lethal it's going to end up being, whether its lethality will evolve. My own view is that since it's so highly transmissible, it will not have to become more benign, which is usually the case with viruses. But what is certain is that the interruptions in the supply chains are going to cause lots and lots of problems, and already are. Store shelves in this area are now becoming empty of vital things. People, you know, when I was doing the studies of nuclear war, John Holdren, who was eventually Obama's science advisor and Clinton's science advisor, and I did a back-of-the-envelope calculation. When we had thousands of nuclear warheads pointed at Russia and vice versa, we calculated it would take about 12 Hiroshima-sized bombs, that's about 15 kilotons, to destroy the United States as an entity and kill most Americans, because all you have to do is bring down the grid and hit the main transport centers, and you can't pump gas, so you can't move food, and most people would just starve. And it turned out that something like 10 would do Russia the same way, because they have fewer nodes that you have to take out to destroy their transport system and starve their population. And we still, by the way, I think we have 1,500 deployed nuclear warheads at the moment. Maybe it's more than that, somewhere between 1,500 and 2,000.
And a great deal of them precariously based in Turkey at the present time.
Well, and also remember, John and I did the calculation on 15 kiloton warheads. Now they got megaton warheads. I mean, the situation, I call it mutually assured imbecility. And yet, I mean, what's the excuse? Why would we want to be able to destroy Russia or vice versa? When you have the nuclear weapons of the world in the hands of nutcases like Trump, like the leader of North Korea, like Putin, you know, you have real thugs running the world and able to destroy it, and it's scary as hell. Right. Unless, like me, if you're 88 years old with heart disease, what the hell?
Well, madness and miscalculation are perhaps the biggest worries in connection with this.
Well, we've come very close just accidentally. My life was saved by a Russian military man, I can't remember what his rank was, when there was a false alarm, and he was commanded basically to launch a full-scale nuclear strike on the U.S., and he refused. Individuals have managed to save humanity, but how many times can you go to the well on that kind of a test?
I must ask you, while we don't stray too far from the subject of population, you predicted worldwide famine in the 70s and 80s, and it's been widely said that the chemical industry, the agricultural chemical industry, saved the day. What do you say to that?
Well, first of all, my latest estimate, if I recall, it was a few years ago, is about 300 million people have starved to death since that was written. There's about 2 billion now are at least micronutrient malnourished. And what the chemical industry has done is develop some temporarily excellent tools for keeping the system running. The part of it we owe to a German who, during the First World War, found a way to make make ammunition out of the air and make fertilizer out of the air. That was Fritz Haber, who with a colleague developed a process for getting the nitrogen that's needed for both explosives and plant growth from the nitrogen in the atmosphere. And he then went on working on poison gas after that. No question, if we hadn't had those developments and we did not have the genetic developments in the so-called Green Revolution, then the starvation would have been much, much higher. What basically was done around the 1950s and 60s was take a technology already developed and deployed in the rich countries and deployed it to the poor countries, where it was adopted very rapidly by particularly rich farmers and increased the food supply dramatically, and enough so that everybody could be fed if the food were reasonably distributed, which it isn't. The problem is we keep on growing. We're keeping on wrecking our soils. We are toxifying now the entire planet by the chemical industry, leading to all kinds of problems. And we have no agricultural technology that's brand new to distribute around the world. So the situation now is considerably more desperate and faced by billions more people. In other words, it's a lot easier to feed 3.5 billion people than 8 billion people. And if we're unlucky with the climate, then we may see actual, not just distributional shortages, but actual shortages. Not enough food to distribute. Even if you distributed it fairly, everybody would not get enough.
What sort of a world are we going to be looking at in a couple of decades' time?
Well, fortunately, I won't be around, so I can predict, and I'll never be proven wrong from my point of view, but I think it's going to be really crappy. If society holds together, I think the trends towards fascism, the trends towards wrecking our life support systems and so on, is going to mean that people are going to live very, if they're around, very much more unsatisfactory lives. We made a lot of progress starting around the 1960s in the U.S., but then we got Ronald Reagan and he turned it all around, and it, you know, went downhill rapidly until the bad side of our nation was really taken hold of and put prominent by Trump. And even if they get rid of Trump, which is questionable, it's going to take when we only have a few decades to get something done about climate disruption, about the toxics, about the threatening, the nuclear threat and so on, it's going to take a very long time to rebuild both the government and hopefully the ethical side of American society, which in the past has done some good things, but we haven't got the time. So I'm very pessimistic, but I'm still going to keep raving on podcasts and writing and trying to persuade people to do things differently.
We hope you'll do that for a considerable time to come. I remember that when your book came out, people were talking about going back to Malthus. Now I hope they'll be going back to Ehrlich.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure talking to you. Let's do it again sometime.
Thank you, Paul.
My pleasure. Thank you. Bye-bye.